A Syrian family starts over in California, today on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. A Syrian family fled the war with only photos and memories.
My grandma, my friends.
That's you as a little girl in Syria, and your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your home in Syria?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now the family's starting a new life in Turlock, California. Also, what does the word Hapa mean? To this woman, almost everything.
To learn the word Hapa really gave me a sense of belonging for the first time in my life.
Plus, Volkswagen faces the wrath of both government and customers.
People are, at the very least, feeling a little bit betrayed because they went out there trying to find something that balanced mileage, performance, and kept the air clear.
That's all ahead here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. There seems to be no stopping the migrants and refugees who continue to flow into Europe. They keep arriving despite moves by several governments to block their path. Hungary is putting up more razor wire along its borders to keep migrants out. That sent thousands of Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans, and others toward Croatia. Authorities there have opened a reception camp just across the border with Serbia. We reached reporter Rebecca Collard this afternoon in the Croatian border town of Tovarnik. She was at a crowded train station there.
Right now we have busload after busload of people arriving, and these people are getting on trains bound, we think, for Hungary, but nobody here seems to know exactly where these trains are going.
And are they optimistic, or are they getting a little frustrated at this point?
I think most of all people are confused. You could imagine right now watching families come out of these buses carrying their children, getting on trains, and not knowing where they're going. And I think that, of course, that's really unsettling. Everybody here seems, you know, optimistic that they will eventually make it to their destination. And for most people, that destination is Germany or Norway or another Western European country. But I think a lot of people now, of course, they're tired. One family I just spoke to from Damascus spent last night in this camp that's been set up by the Croatian government, basically to kind of hold and process people before sending them on. And now they're on a train to a location unknown for them. So for them, of course, it's confusing and it's tiring, and so many people traveling with small children. Right now I can see them hanging out the window. There's some volunteers here giving away water and also toys for the children, bits of food for their journey onward.
You know, the pictures that I've been seeing over the weekend on television make it seem like, you know, at any moment there could really be an unpleasant confrontation. Does it feel that way there on the ground?
I think we've seen a few unpleasant confrontations in the last few days. I was in Horgos. This is the crossing on the Serbian side. It's Roške on the Hungarian side last week. And there was a really intense confrontation between Hungarian police and the refugees that were on the Serbian side. The police were firing tear gas, the Hungarian police, into Serbian territory to try to disperse people using water cannons. Well, the people on the Serbian side, the refugees, were throwing rocks and burning tires. And I mean, it was a really intense scene, and I think for a lot of people, definitely some of the people I spoke to, reminiscent of things that they were actually trying to flee in the Middle East and North Africa. Here at this train station in Tovarnik, I was here 2 days ago. It was extremely chaotic. You just had hundreds, if not thousands, of people kind of on the railway tracks. And then when the train would come, everybody would push to get on the train, and you had people, you know, pushing their friends and their children in through windows, and just intense scenes, very chaotic, just people so desperate to get on this train that they think is going to bring them, they hope, to Western Europe. What we're seeing today is far more organized, Aaron. We have a row of police officers with riot gear on. The buses come, people are let out 10 by 10. They walk into the train, they get into the train. Once they're seated, the next bus goes. So I think that there's this effort now to kind of make things less chaotic, to make things more organized. But of course, when we're talking about numbers of up to 10,000 people crossing borders every day, it's really difficult to see how this can remain orderly.
Reporter Rebecca Collard at the train station in Tovarnik, Croatia. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Starting over in a new country, that's what all those refugees and migrants arriving in Europe are facing if they succeed. Many of them are from Syria, and some, just a sliver of the millions who fled, are arriving in the U.S. The World's Monica Campbell met one Syrian family in Turlock, a farming city in Northern California.
There were many reasons to leave. Wahajid Al-Khalifa talks about what happened to her brother in Homs, Syria. He was pulled over at a military checkpoint, accused of being an anti-government activist. He was tortured and nearly killed. Her husband, Jassim Al-Hamad, talks about what happened to his family. One brother killed by a barrel bomb, and another brother went missing.
We were looking in the hospitals and the police stations, and at the sudden, friends of us called us, and he said, there's someone on the streets. It looks like your brother. Come and see him.
Jassim shows me a video he took. He put it on Facebook. We see his brother dead, bound by his hands and feet. He worked at a sugar factory in Syria and was rounded up by soldiers, arbitrarily, his brother says. Jassim says his brother stayed out of politics, but the violence back home is indiscriminate. The next day, Jassim and Wahajid fled with their young children. Now, everything's different. They're here in Turlock, a small city in rural Northern California. There aren't many Syrians here, but it's cheaper than San Francisco, even though there are more Syrians there. And it took 3 years to arrive. After living in a refugee camp in Jordan, after interviews and security checks, they finally got word they'd be resettled in the U.S. Pure luck of the draw at a time when the U.S. only takes in a tiny amount of Syrian refugees. The family arrived in February. Wahajid, speaking through an interpreter, shows me their new kitchen.
Microwave.
Coffee maker.
The coffee maker.
Yeah. One in matbakh.
Utensils.
All the utensils.
All donated. And her husband, Jassim, shows me their closet, stuffed with donations from their neighbors.
They gave us all these clothes.
There's also furniture, a table, chairs, purchased by the International Rescue Committee. The group resettled the family. From Syria, they only have pictures. That's it. Their 9-year-old daughter, Ara, shows me her small album. She started learning English at the refugee camp in Jordan.
That's from Syria.
That's you as a little girl in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your home in Syria?
Oh, yeah.
Ara says she likes it here, though. There's a pool in the apartment complex, and it's hot, like back home. I ask her what she misses about Syria. She closes her eyes and thinks.
My grandma. My friends.
Your friends.
She also misses her two uncles, but they're disabled and can't leave Syria. The relatives left behind weigh on her parents, but they're trying to focus on building a life here. Jassim got a job fast.
Butcher.
He's a butcher at a slaughterhouse. He knows how to cut meat according to Islamic law, the halal way. The skills in demand. They also want to meet people, and people here want to meet them. Their neighbor, Ayman Achak, remembers seeing the family at the mosque here. Everybody spotted the newcomers right away.
Each family member brought in something. Because they're lonely, they don't know nobody around here, they don't know what to do, they don't have the language, and nothing, completely nothing.
The tight-knit mosque community chipped in and got the family a lot of what's in the apartment. A television, too. But the mom, Wahajid, says that's mostly for the kids.
I don't watch news now. I get, like, sad.
I asked if they'd want to go back to Syria. They say they want to go back when it's stable. But where they'll live is another question. They got bad news the other day.
I received some pictures and destroyed.
A neighbor sent a photo of their house, flattened by a bomb. So they're focusing on being here. And Jassim, the dad, is excited about something new. He brings me to the parking lot.
This is your minivan.
Yes.
He's taking the driver's test tomorrow. I ask him if he's nervous.
Yes. Inshallah. Inshallah.
It'll be a challenge for Jassim, but nothing, nothing compared to what he and his family have survived. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Turlock, California.
Millions of Syrians have left their country to escape the war, but as we just heard in that story, not everyone's gone. There's still that old neighbor who sent Jassim a picture of his bombed-out home, and many more like him trying to carry on in the middle of a war zone. To hear about that, we decided to check back in with reporter Rasha Elas. A couple years ago, she visited a Damascus neighborhood called Zamalka, which had been hit by a deadly chemical attack by government forces. She told us about some of the people she met there, like a 16-year-old boy named Mohammed Al-Zaiba. He lost his entire family in the attack, as he told Rasha 2 years ago.
Among them, his mother and father, his five brothers and sisters, two aunts, two uncles, and all of their children.
Rasha's on the line with us now. And Rasha, it's been almost 2 years since the attack. You've kept in contact with some of the people in Zamalka who you met. What is life like there now?
Well, it's not very different from how it was 2 years ago. It's just a lot worse. You know, they've been living under a siege that started in 2012. When I was there, we were lucky when we had, you know, some bread with the olives and the cheese. Maybe we had an egg that day. I spent 3 days there, and I have to say, I never experienced that level of hunger. So by now, a lot of people have actually started to eat grass just to supplement the olives and cheese that basically their daily diet.
Now, you painted a pretty horrific picture of a neighborhood under siege, and the Syrian army at the time was actually cordoning off the neighborhood. And there's a horrible story you told us about a young boy who wasn't allowed to bring in a bag of bread. Why this lockdown? Is it just because this was the place where the chemical attack happened?
No, this is a government siege. It's part of a government campaign called the Starvation Until Submission. But the scene that I saw stuck with me because the soldier who looked so pained to have to execute his orders in that way and tell a child, no, you cannot bring the bread with you. And he kept telling the child, look, my officer, the boss, he's looking. So anyway, this is part of the government sort of keeping the rebel-held areas under siege to exhaust the rebels and exhaust the population there. And in fact, that's how the government has been able to do ceasefire agreements with a lot of these areas, because the rebels basically get so tired and hungry, and that's why they accept a ceasefire that is not usually to their advantage.
Now, in addition to reporting in Syria, you also have lots of friends and family there, though not in that Zamalka neighborhood. What are they telling you about their lives now?
Basically, it depends on what day of the week you call. You might call them on a Monday and they'll be under sort of heavy rocket attack from the rebel areas where mortar shells are being sent over to Damascus. They fall in schoolyards and public parks. They happen every day. We don't hear about them anymore because, frankly, they've become old news. They've become a daily occurrence. And we also don't have a lot of international media in there.
Now, Rasha, you were living in Lebanon and traveling in and out of Syria as a reporter. You've stopped that and you're back now in the U.S. Why did you come back?
Well, you know, it's difficult. I was there as a private citizen and I worked as a journalist, basically without saying I was a journalist. So you can only do that for so long. I did it for 2 years and basically attracted too much attention. And now they know that I'm a journalist.
Freelance journalist Rasha Elas speaking to us now from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we bring Nina Porzuki in for a look at the word Hapa. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Soundworks.org, where you can find podcasts from PRI's The World, including The World's Daily Podcast and The World in Words with Patrick Cox, exploring language in all its glorious complexity. Subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're listening to The World. Our own Nina Porzucchi is in the studio with me.
Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Nina. You are one half of our language podcast, The World in Words.
That's right.
And recently a friend asked you to get to the bottom of a single word, HAPA, H-A-P-A. Let's start with how that word is used.
Well, I'm going to actually let my friend Julie Jimenez explain.
The way that I've come to understand it, and for me, it's half Asian and half Caucasian, or half of something else and half Asian, which is what I am.
So Julie's father is from Chile, and her mom is Japanese-American. And as you heard, she calls herself HAPA. And she never had questioned this definition before until recently. She was in a grocery store, and she saw a woman who she thought looked HAPA, and she used the word, and the woman said this to her.
Oh, you know, that's a Hawaiian word. You're not supposed to really use that word. And I had never heard anyone say that before.
So it got Julie thinking, what does this word HAPA actually mean? And she asked me to get to the bottom of it.
All right, Nina, never one to pass up a challenge.
Nope.
You did. And what did you find out?
Well, I started here on YouTube.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to our new show on ISA TV, where we explore the world of part Asian Pacific Islanders everywhere. Halftime! I'm Joanna Sotomora, and this is my co-host, Stephen Chang. And we are both mixed. We're both HAPA.
Who better to know about the meaning of the word HAPA than Joanna Sotomora and Stephen Chang, hosts of the YouTube series Halftime. Both have one Asian parent and one white parent, and they both self-identify as HAPA. So I called them up, and when it came to actually defining the word, well...
Is it like an acronym? Is that a word?
You know, to be totally honest, I have no idea what the origins of this word are.
I thought it meant half, like it's ha, there's like half, like Pacific Asian. I don't know.
You're just
I
making facts
was,
up now.
No, is that not?
I have no idea.
Not quite the definition I was hoping for. But while they might not exactly know how the term came to be, they certainly feel defined by it. For Sotomora, she can't pinpoint the first time she actually heard the word.
Well, for me, I'm from Hawaii, and that term is used all the time, from the time you're little, just describing different ethnicities and peoples and mixes. It's just something that I grew up with, and yeah, I actually think it's kind of funny now that we're bringing that word to a kind of like mainstream culture.
One of the early champions of the word is Wei Ming Dariotis, an Asian American studies professor at San Francisco State University. She first learned about the word during graduate school, and it kind of changed her life.
I really started to see myself as being part of a larger community, larger than the community of the just one Chinese, Greek, Swedish, English, Scottish, German, Pennsylvania, Dutch girl, which was me. To learn the word HAPA really gave me a sense of belonging for the first time in my life.
Wei Ming became an evangelist for the word. She planned HAPA holiday parties, HAPA retreats. She pioneered an entire HAPA studies department at her university. And then one week, she was invited to speak at another California college, and she used the word HAPA during her lecture. Afterwards, a woman approached her and said,
I'm part Native Hawaiian, and when I hear you use the word HAPA, knowing that you're not part Native Hawaiian, and she actually used this term. She said, it feels like my culture is being raped from me. And she was in tears.
How did that feel? I mean, you must have...
Well, it felt horrible. You know, it feels horrible to make anybody else feel that way. I had to think about the fact that the Hawaiian language was almost completely stripped away by European contact. The only remnants for many years of Native Hawaiian culture were just what could be sold to tourists.
Wei Ming continued to use the word, but the doubts, they just kept piling on. And ultimately, she stopped. But as it turns out, her misconception about the word may actually be a misconception itself. Hawaiian linguist Keao Naismith says HAPA isn't actually a native Hawaiian word at all.
HAPA derives from English. It's a Hawaiian pronunciation of the English word half. We do use it to mean half. We also use it to mean part.
So HAPA then originally was an adapted word from
right,
English.
So the word HAPA is a HAPA term.
Naismith says HAPA was already being used in the early 19th century. When missionaries from Boston arrived in Hawaii in the 1820s, they did two things quickly: translate the Bible into Hawaiian and establish schools. And in doing so, they needed to come up with a curriculum.
And so HAPA is a result of the attempt to develop math curriculum. The term half was used initially in more of a mathematical context.
The word quickly became shorthand for half of anything, including people. And from early in the 1830s, Naismith can find examples of the use of another phrase, hapahauli. Hauli is the Hawaiian word for outsider.
So hapahauli originally meant someone who was mixed ethnic Hawaiian and also these other foreigners who came who happened to be white.
Naismith himself happens to be hapahauli. His mom is native Hawaiian, his dad is white, and he was surprised to hear the word hapa being used by people of mixed Asian and Caucasian heritage. Surprised, he says, but not offended.
I just thought, wow, that's kind of cool that Hawaiians would have that kind of external influence, which I had not expected or anticipated or even knew.
I told him about Wei Ming's experience. She stopped using it after she had this conversation with a young woman and thought a lot about the Hawaiian language and what foreigners had done to decimate the Hawaiian language and Hawaiian culture. And by like reappropriating this word and taking it again, it felt like another kind of taking away of my language.
Isn't that so ironic, though? I mean, it's not even a truly Hawaiian word, is it? It's borrowed from English, you know? So now we're saying it's purely Hawaiian. That's quite ironic, I think.
Words are rarely as pure as we project them to be. The more we use them, the more they change. And so this word hapa, used by so many people in so many contexts, it's complicated. And how people feel about the word? Complicated. Remember Joanna Snotomora and Stephen Chang, the two hosts of Halftime, that YouTube show? They have an entire show that's hapa-focused, and even they go back and forth on the word.
This is my final opinion. I don't know if I like the word. I'm thinking about it.
Hapa?
Yeah. Because if you create a term for a certain race of people, right, based on their ethnicity, we just put another box on the paper, man. It's like you got, I can check black, I can check white, I can check Asian, I can check Pacific Islander, I can check Hapa. It's just like another box. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's like, do I want my own category so I can like relate to people? But do I really want that category? Because then it's just going to put me in a box.
As for Wei Ming, she's still looking for a new word to replace Hapa.
And I'm not sure that it's even really possible or desirable, because in some ways, having these debates is really what we should be doing.
And for my friend Julie, who tasked me with the initial question, what does Hapa mean? I called her up with my answers.
Hello?
Julie?
Yes, hi.
She was in her car. And after I told her what I found, she told me she's going to keep using the word.
How people use words and how people identify, it's personal. And to me, being Hapa is personal.
So Nina, that's very cool. Your friend Julie is going to keep describing herself as Hapa. But I was wondering what she thought about the quest that you went on.
Well, Aaron, you're just going to have to go listen to the World in Words podcast. This is just a small slice of the story. You can subscribe on iTunes to the World in Words, or you can go to our website, pri.org/language.
Excellent. Nina, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
And this is The World.
What is it?
The World. Shboom. I'm Aaron Schachter. This artist and dissident says Pope Francis is visiting Cuba at the beginning of a new era.
It's the era of the people, not the era of the dissidents or the era of the government. It's the era of the normal, everyday Cuban people. And this is what I personally would like to fight for.
A conversation with Tanya Bruguera, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Enthusiastic crowds turned out to greet Pope Francis in eastern Cuba today. This is the third and last full day of the pontiff's visit to the island. He leaves for the U.S. tomorrow. The pope's stay in Cuba hasn't been without controversy. Two dissidents who tried to attend a papal event at Havana's cathedral were detained by authorities, even though they said they'd been invited by the Vatican.
I think the government is very nervous right now. They're very afraid.
That's U.S.-based Cuban artist Tanya Bruguera. She spent much of the past year stranded in Cuba. Officials there confiscated her passport after she tried to stage an open mic performance in Revolution Square in Havana. Now Bruguera is back in the U.S. and a fellow at Yale. She says Cubans are still waiting for freedom of expression.
They just have an artist in prison called El Sexto for wanting to do a performance. They just closed a theater company for wanting to put a UNESCO theater play called The King is Dying. And now we're having a lot of problems with people who are in the movie industry. The independent production of cinema in Cuba is under a lot of pressure, a lot of surveillance. So you can see those are signs of the fear the government has of art and the power of art.
Tanya, what do you make of all the hoopla and the mood of celebration in Cuba right now with the arrival of the Pope and his meeting with Fidel and Raul Castro? What's your take? Is this indeed a moment of hope for Cubans?
I've been following yesterday the arrival, all the speeches they have done, and it seems actually that Raul, who has been demonstrated that he's a very skillful politician, is using this actually to negotiate the end of the embargo with the United States. So he's using the political leverage of the Pope. So I feel that in a way the Pope is being used by the Cuban government. At the same time, you have good moments. Like, for example, there was this young guy who did an amazing speech yesterday in front of the cathedral where he claimed for change and he claimed for being together while being different. And I think it was beautiful to see how people were cheering those messages. But the messages are not coming from the Pope, are not coming from the Cuban government. They are coming from the people who I think they are tired to be play with.
Well, in a sense, though, I mean, aren't dissidents using the Pope just a little bit for cover? I mean, in old Cuba, wouldn't that man have been hauled away to jail immediately?
Yeah, I'm going to say something maybe some of my dissident friend will not like, but I think we're living a new era in Cuba now, and it's the era of the people, not the era of the dissidents or the era of the government. It's the era of the normal, everyday Cuban people. And this is what I personally would like to fight for.
So it is then a good thing that there is this thaw in relations between Washington and Havana.
I agree. I think something could change, which is something that for 50 years we were very much indoctrinated and showed every time somebody wanted to change something that it was not going to be possible, that they would not have power to change anything. The problem is that that hope that came the 17th of December quickly has been tried to be controlled by the government. I always say that they even want to control enthusiasm, you know. Now, I would like to see the Pope giving the message a little more clearly to people and less politically. Although I still love this Pope. I think this Pope is amazing. Hmm.
In his public speeches, he has really kind of poked the Castros in the eye just a little bit, right?
Yeah, he did a little bit.
Yeah. Do you think they, or Raul, I guess, understands or accepts the notion that change is coming?
I think the Cuban government and Raul and all the people around him knows that the change is coming because they have been the one asking for the change. They might have understood that another power can be achieved, the power of economics. So we are looking now at a moment in which political power is being translated into economical power, meaning that the one who are going to have access to whatever economical progress we have or chances we have are going to be the people next to political power. So I think they have done these amazing theatricals where they try to pretend maybe in 1, 2, 3 years that they're not in power, where they're actually, like the Russians, you know, they're actually behind all the economic power and therefore politics. You know, and I think distribution of wealth right now is the main issue that we have to deal with together with freedom of expression.
Can you go back to make art?
I'm going to go back. That's a decision
you
I have
are.
Made the day I left. But the day I was giving my passport, like as my hand was reaching the passport and the secret police person had the other side of my passport, he was saying, "You know that if we want, you will never come back here, right?"
Well, but as you said, no matter what they say or do, you are going to go back to Cuba. What kind of art do you hope to make when you get back to Cuba?
Well, I think art can be a very useful tool for people who express what they don't know how to express, like how to talk about unformed thoughts, how can they deal with fear. Art actually has a very good space to substitute political speeches, to substitute ideologies, and going to the soul of people and going to the fears and the desires of people. And this is what I wanted to do.
Cuban installation and performance artist Tania Bruguera. She's currently a fellow at Yale. Thank you so much, Tania.
Thank you so very much.
Volkswagen shares tumbled 20% in trading today, losing billions of dollars in value. That's just one way to measure the trouble the German automaker is now facing. VW is looking at billions more in fines after admitted cheating on U.S. emissions tests, specifically tests of its diesel engine models. The admission reportedly came only under pressure from the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Justice Department is now investigating the matter. Paul Eisenstein covers the auto industry at the Detroit Bureau. He describes how VW manipulated those emissions tests.
It appears they used something that's being described as a defeat device. It's not an actual device. It's not like they put some black box under the hood. But what they did was they wrote in software into the engine controller that operates the engine and all the pollution control technology. As a result, it was able to figure out when the cars were being tested. And when they were, it toughened up the emissions control system. So it put out less particulates and less oxides of nitrogen, which are related to smog. And then when the cars were back on the road, apparently a lot of those control systems were deactivated.
So what does the scam mean for pollution and for public health?
Well, if you have more of these materials, particulates and oxides of nitrogen coming out, you'll get a lot more potential smog. There's some concern that particulates could cause cancer. So you're creating a lot more of these bad things coming out of the tailpipe.
Okay, now here's the point where I admit I am a consumer. I own a Volkswagen Jetta TDI. I certainly bought the car thinking about the environment, thinking about the gas mileage, that I was doing a good thing, and I enjoy the performance. Any idea what customers are thinking about these days?
Well, I am sure that people are at the very least feeling a little bit betrayed because they went out there trying to find something that balanced mileage, performance, and kept the air clear. And they may lose. You may lose some of that performance once they come up with a fix. You know, we already have the legal vultures circling. We've already heard about several class action lawsuits against VW.
Well, the EPA is talking about an $18 billion fine.
And I don't really believe that VW would be hit with the maximum fine. $18 billion is pretty devastating. However, they're still going to get hit pretty hard from a lot of different places. So not only do you have the EPA ready to fine them, the California Air Resources Board would likely fine them because they have their own standards that are even tougher than the federal rules. The Justice Department has indicated that it may weigh in, and I've got a feeling that they'll probably wind up getting some sort of settlements from VW.
Has Volkswagen been accused of this trickery in Europe as well, or does it not matter there?
At the moment, the European regulators are saying they're watching what's happening in the United States. I imagine they're already in touch with the EPA to find out what sort of evidence they have. And it's not clear that Volkswagen used the same defeat device in Europe that they used here because the standards there are slightly different.
So have they essentially, Volkswagen, have they admitted doing this?
They have said that they're sorry for the problem. I think they've walked a fine line without crossing over into admitting guilt in such a way that it would stand up in court. But they clearly recognize they have a problem and that they've lost the trust of consumers, according to a statement that came from their CEO, Martin Winterkorn.
And what do you think, Paul, this does for the whole image of green cars?
Well, it's really sad to see this happening because diesels have been gaining traction in the U.S. after being largely out of the market for two decades. If you recall, the diesels of the 80s were sluggish, they smelled, they just didn't click with American consumers. The new so-called clean diesels, which were quick, fuel efficient, and supposedly clean, have really been finding an audience. 25% of VW products sold in the U.S. are diesels. One of the questions that's being asked, if other European automakers use the same trickery. Daimler, which owns Mercedes-Benz, weighed in and said, no, we did not use this technology. I bet a lot of consumers are wondering right now if this is just a unique situation or not. But I would be surprised if regulators, both at the federal level and in California, aren't looking at the software of all sorts of manufacturers to make sure that this sort of thing isn't more prevalent than we realized.
Incredible story. Reporter Paul Eisenstein at thedetroitbureau.com. Thanks a lot, Paul.
My pleasure.
Let's welcome back the world's Marco Werman. He's in the hosting chair tomorrow after 2 weeks in Mumbai, India, with our Her Rights team. You heard their in-depth coverage of women's rights in India all of last week here on the show. And Marco, you left Mumbai early Saturday morning, India time, back here in Boston Saturday afternoon, Eastern time. It's a crazy trip. Culture shock much?
Yeah, culture shock a lot. Kind of wondering on Saturday afternoon when I was sitting on my back porch and hearing the breeze in the leaves of the trees in my backyard.
Not traffic,
which is all you would hear in Mumbai. Whether any of that had just happened to me over the last 2 weeks. I think the hardest thing, and I've never been on an assignment where I've felt it as much, was toggling between the really poor people that I was speaking with, a lot of women in the slums of Mumbai, and then getting back to the hotel where the lobby was air conditioned and it smelled of kind of orange blossom and ginger, and just, you know, completely puts your privilege in check. But, you know, it's kind of the city is that way. It's not monochrome. It's not just poor. You've got some of the richest people in the world living there. I saw a brand new Rolls Royce blocking a street to a bunch of auto rickshaws behind it. You know, it's like a $200,000 car. I saw a dreadlock beggar outside of a Chanel boutique. So it's all these contrasts. I mean, I interviewed a woman the very first day who had acid thrown in her face by her brother-in-law. We met her in her home in the slum. Just a fan was on, no air conditioning, completely sweaty. And then you come back to the hotel. So that was really tough and kind of hard to toggle between those worlds. But that's how a lot of wealthy Indians in Bombay seem to exist alongside all the people who've come to Bombay to eke out a living. There's a great line by the writer Suketu Mehta, who came out a few years ago with a book about Mumbai called Maximum City. And let me read you this one line, Aaron. There's resentment that Bombay has to deal with the country's detritus. The only consolation is that the huddled masses are also the talent pool for South Bombay's maids, drivers, peons. South Bombay, by the way, is where a lot of the wealthy live in Mumbai. That is part of the attraction of living here, he writes. You can find a maid and pay her a monthly salary smaller than the cost of breakfast at the Taj Hotel.
Yeah, it's just incredible. What's with the name? Is it Bombay or is it Mumbai?
Yeah, it really depends on who's talking. The official name now is Mumbai. It was changed in 1995, really by Hindu nationalists who wanted to ditch the colonial Bombay, which came actually from Portuguese settlers in the 16th century, Bombaia. Bombay means good bay. The Hindu nationalists had been pushing local identity and authenticity, Marathi being the main language in Maharashtra state where Mumbai is. So they named the city Mumbai, meaning mother in Marathi. So if you go by the official proclamation or if you're Marathi in your blood and speak it, you say Mumbai. If you dispense with all that for whatever reason, you know, nostalgia, maybe you grew up when it was Bombay, or you just reject identity politics and you say Bombay.
So you mentioned the Taj Hotel. That's where you were staying, right?
Yeah, we were staying at one of two Tajs, the one that was attacked in 2008 by militants, the Lashkar-e-Taiba attack. That one is still standing, and that is in South Mumbai. We were in the Taj Hotel in the Bandra neighborhood, and this one seems to be favored by rich Indians for weddings, and there was a huge tent being set up for a wedding last Saturday.
This disparity makes the place seem like, at least from the outside, it's a city on the edge. Is that true? What holds it together?
I always had this kind of like constant little feeling of panic in the back of my mind that how does it all work? Isn't it all going to just like come to a kind of complete collapse? You know, but the auto rickshaws, these little three-wheeled scooters that take you around, as stressful as those rides are, you kind of get used to it because they're efficient. They feel like bumper cars that just never crash. Stray dogs and cats, really kind of pathetic, but they get fed. Interestingly, they get fed by some of the poorest people in the city, but they're taken care of. And even my teeth, you know, I had this like temporary crown kept falling out. And Chavi, our producer on the ground, said, give her to my dentist. She'll see you in 20 minutes if you can get there before one, because they're taking the days off for Ganesh Festival. I got there. She cemented it back in, charged me $9. So,
and now we have to let you go to the dentist here, but you'll be back tomorrow. Marco Werman, thanks for coming in for a few minutes.
Happy to do it, Aaron.
Ahead, we end the show with some flamenco right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're tuned to The World. To vaccinate or not to vaccinate, it's a much-discussed issue here in the United States, and now in Ukraine, too. The government there fears a major polio outbreak after two children were reported to have been paralyzed by the disease earlier this month. So health officials have announced a national immunization campaign. It would cover about 5 million children ages 10 and under. But as our BBC colleague David Stern reports from Kiev, not all parents are willing to have their kids vaccinated.
Olga and Anatoly Makarenko are two of these parents who have decided not to immunize their children. Dima, 7, Ksenia, 5, and Varvara, 1. As her children run about in a nearby playground, Olga tells me that she doesn't trust the vaccines that are brought into Ukraine.
Nobody knows how the vaccines were stored. No one knows if the expiry dates were changed. Vaccines are serious things. There are too many things you can't check.
Olga also tells me that Dima already caught whooping cough. Nothing bad happened to him, proving she has nothing to fear. If her children catch polio, she says, she thinks timely medical attention and homeopathic remedies will protect them.
There's always a risk, but for me this risk is much smaller than the one from vaccinations.
But health experts say just the opposite, that there is nothing to fear from Ukraine's vaccines, and that the risk is much, much greater not to immunize. It's one of the last hot days of the year, and I'm at a fountain in the center of Kiev. There are children splashing about all around me. Polio can be spread a number of ways, including by water and personal contact. And health experts now fear that this virus could cut a deadly path through this largely unprotected population. Together with the World Health Organization, Ukraine says that it will begin a massive national immunization campaign for all children under 10. This will involve around 5 million children and more than 11 million vaccines. Dr. Dorit Nitsan is the head of the WHO in Ukraine. She says that without significant action soon, the chance of a major outbreak is high.
The situation is tragic. It is tragic because whatever you look at it, if it's going to be now, tomorrow, or next month, it's coming. And it's coming big time because children in Ukraine are not immunized against polio and against many other diseases.
But Ukraine's health system is riddled with corruption and decay, and the government is often hampered by political infighting. Last week, the health minister narrowly avoided being sacked. Dr. Nitsan says polio is potentially a national health emergency. Now is not the time to squabble or hesitate.
We'll do our best.
But you say trust takes time, and you don't have time.
We don't have time, so we are going to tell them the truth. You are risking your children. Look at your child now. He might look different for the rest of his life or her life. So we are telling them, move, don't mix your trust with the state, with the care of your children.
Dorit Nitsan, head of the WHO in Ukraine, ending that report by our BBC colleague David Stern in Kiev. Finally, flamenco music is from Spain, right? Well, the flamenco guitarist you're about to meet was born in Armenia, back when the country was part of the Soviet Union. His family left in 1991, bound for Los Angeles. Beto Arcos takes it from there.
Flamenco guitarist Vahagny was 6 years old when he and his family landed at the airport in L.A.
And I remember when we got to LAX, I was kind of disappointed because I thought we were literally going to land into Disneyland, you know, or something like that. After a while, I think my first impressions were just constantly having to adapt, you know, because I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anything about America. I was six. So it was the transitional period that I remember a lot.
Vahagny's father had been a guitar soloist for the National Philharmonic Orchestra of Armenia, but he also loved flamenco. Ever since he saw a performance of Paco de Lucia on TV in the early 1980s.
And it just blew his mind because it was the first time he's seen something like that and someone play guitar that way. So he was fascinated and just started doing all the research he can to find out more about this, and it became like an obsession.
Vahagny says a flamenco album even played a part in his parents getting together.
When he met my mom, she happened to really like the music. So I guess maybe he had too much wine to drink or something. He gifted it to her, you know, as a present. And then I think the next morning he woke up and said, Jesus, what did I do? And so he was kind of forced to marry her, you know, to get the disc back. That's the anecdote in the family. That's how they got together.
When Vahagny began playing the guitar at the age of 9, he listened to three types of music: classical, Armenian, and of course, flamenco.
That was the soundtrack of my growing up. I was already so exposed to it, and it was something very normal for me. So it wasn't like a decision I made. Oh, I want to learn more about flamenco, and I want to play flamenco. It was just, that was part of life from a very young age, was that music.
And when he was 18, Vahagny moved to Andalusia to learn from the source.
I got to study with some amazing guitarists. Besides that, just living there, just being there and going out and having a beer in Andalusia. You learn a lot from that as well.
Last year, Vahagny got a chance to work with the Spanish singer Buica. While they were on tour, he played some Armenian melodies for her, and he asked her to record an Armenian folk song, Hov Arek Sarer Jan. The song is on his new album titled Imagine Frequencies. Looking back at his life and career, Vahagny says he didn't choose to become a flamenco guitarist. He never thought he'd do anything else. For The World, I'm Beto Arcos.
That's our show for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman is back tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.